Welcome to the Food Matters live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're following the money and looking ahead and asking, where will investors be putting their cash in 2023? It's not necessarily a straightforward question. The world is complex at the moment. We've had heat waves and floods, the ongoing war and devastation in Ukraine, inflation and economic turmoil. So what does this mean for investors? Is food and agritech still a good bet? Whatever happens, people have to eat after all. But what about the detail? If we were recording this podcast 12 months ago, alternative meat and agritech would be two of the big hitters in the investment world. But there are signs of a slowdown in both these areas. So, where are the sharp-eyed investors looking as 2023 unfolds? And where is the smart money heading? With me to discuss this are two absolutely fantastic guests from the world of venture capital. Andrew Ive is the founder of Big Idea Ventures. Hello there, Andrew.
Hello there, Stefan. How are you today?
I'm very, very good. Very good. And Ivan Fanetti is managing partner at Five Season Ventures. Hello there, Ivan.
Hello, everybody.
Before we look ahead, let's first look back. There have been many unexpected events in 2022, but have there been any surprises in the food sector? Maybe investments which have surpassed expectations, Andrew? And, well, you know, anything that really struck you from 2022?
Yes, absolutely. We've had some great companies coming through. I think one of the things, but from a theme perspective, that's been really exciting has been on the sustainability side. We've certainly had a number of companies that have kind of stood out from a performance perspective. We've also been catching up with the promise. And what I mean by that is we've had a number of companies in the food tech alternative protein space over the last 5 or 6 years, where we've been sort of waiting for the promise to be delivered in, let's say, for example, alternative protein, and some great companies coming through over the over those 5 years. In the last year or so, we've seen companies not only kind of being part of that promise, but actually just starting to deliver on it. And what I mean by that is companies who are delivering the products and the ingredients and the technologies that we've been hoping they will and crossing our fingers that they will over the last 5 or 6 years. I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a company in France called Standing Ovation. They're a company in the kind of alternative protein space and casein and cheese. We've had a number of companies taking a swing at trying to get a complete casein so that we can get that cheesiness and that cheese flavor and taste that we're looking for. Many companies have tried. Many haven't quite got there yet. Standing Ovation, we believe, are the first company to deliver. On the cell-based side, we've got companies really trying hard to solve a lot of the parts of the kind of blockers to be able to deliver cell-based meat. And Gourmet, again in France, so this is a lot of flag waving for France today. Gourmet have been able to deliver a product which compares incredibly well, if not better than the foie gras products that they're replacing or able to replace, that we all know has some challenges from a sustainability and from an animal welfare perspective. So Gourmet have been able to deliver on that.
Excellent. And that is quite exciting, that because alternative protein is one of those things that's been lurking for ages. And as you say, delivering the promise is a perfect way of explaining it. Ivan, what about you? Any surprises from 2022 or anything that surpassed your expectations?
You know, we've been crying the wolf for a decade, right, about the bull market coming to an end. And probably February 2021 was the time when the wolf showed up. Nobody would have predicted the way that would have happened or exactly the timing. And to some extent, we had some of the early signs of tide changing even in the last part of 2020, where, or 21, sorry, where inflation started to come up as China stopped exportation. So, you know, basically exporting inflation by result. But it was really when the war started that I think, you know, the penny dropped for everybody. And I think we may talk about some of the implication of commodity pricing later on in this podcast. But that was the time when I think every investor started to pick up again that book of corporate finance that was thrown in the bin for the last few years because nothing made sense. And I think the level of scrutiny that everybody is now applying to existing and new investments, whether because you're doing a new one or because you're refinancing an existing one, has kind of brought to light a number of things where, you know, performance is becoming much more deeply investigated. And it's not just the growth at any cost that some of the businesses that we've seen have been able to, you know, put as a headline to, you know, raise disproportionate amount of money with no business plans. But I think there is the sustainability, not just in terms of the environment, but the financial sustainability of a lot of the businesses that have now been, in the last 10 months, put under a lot of scrutiny. So in a way, you know, it's interesting that Andrew talked about alternative protein. It was one of those two or three themes that everybody fell in love with in the last 2-3 years. Who wouldn't, right? So the promise of, you know, better food, potentially even lower cost, lower impact on resources sounds like a terrific idea, and I think it still is. But I think the new concept is that, you know, sometimes we are long-term optimistic and short-term pessimistic. And I think right now, if you look at the data throughout, there has been maybe a hyperbolic growth of the expectation of what alternative protein could be. And maybe disappointments where taste, price, nutritional value, whatever it is, kind of fell short of expectation. And I think this is not uncommon in tech, right? So the curve, I'll draw it from your side, you know, everybody gets excited and then you kind of get disillusioned, and then maybe the different gradient that technology picks up and consumer adoptance together with it. So I think what's exciting, I think we're now going to get through a period of assessment of the companies that have done really well on first, second generation of products, and they're getting better and better, but without the gun on the head of having to raise another $200 million next month. I think it's more now the time where everybody goes down to the lab again or in manufacturing or whatever it is and really try to get that product to cover the most important feature ever, which is it has to taste great. The first time you discover a new protein, the first time you find an alternative, you know, burger or bacon or whatever, can be for various reasons. There's nothing else to eat. A friend's recommended to you, have a voucher code, you're in a restaurant, you know, whatever, random. The second time you taste that product is because you bought it. And taste is the proxy for, you know, that second purchase encounter, which is the one that is the rational one, the one that you want to do. So a long story to say that, you know, it has been a story where performing companies have now been able to show the real performance. Companies were judged on the ability to raise money without performance, and you know, we all guilty of the same thing. We all follow the same rules. But now I think there are some companies, I'll mention maybe three, that happen to be in our portfolio, because at least I know the numbers, that have performed above expectations this year. And those are three companies that are, you know, if you ask any VC, can you name three companies in your portfolio? Normally the first, second, and third are the first and second best performers, right? So normally there is a bias in there. But I'll start maybe in no particular order, as they say in British TV. This is a company, German company called Yfood. This is the product. It's a meal replacement. You're probably familiar with the British competitor Huel or the American one Soylent. This is a company that is well past the 100 million revenue this year, massively profitable. The taste of this product is superior to any of the other competitor, right? We've tried, we benchmarked everything with data and everything else. It's an amazingly tasting product. And for like €2.50 or €3.50, depending how much you buy, you have a full replacement. Now think about it, in a space where now we're living with inflation, people having to make meats and, you know, this is a great proposition. It's 6 hours of having your hunger taken care of. You get all the nutritionals that you need, macro and micro, and you know, it tastes delicious and job done, move on to the next thing. So there is a great proposition here in a lot of the demographics, and this company has been growing tremendously fast and is probably one of the fastest companies in our portfolio in Europe. But second to this one, again, another company that surprised us completely. And this one, I can only rationalize it up to a certain point, but this company is a company called AirUp, and is now the largest company in our portfolio. So I can't say exactly the number, but yeah, well above 100 million, very profitable. So this is a company that enables people to drink water. So it's a bottle. There's lots of tech. There are 6 or 7 patents around this area. You fill it up with normal water. Tap water in America from the whatever it is, there are different colors and all the gizmos about it. But the interesting thing is this. This cap here, this one particularly has the flavor of cola, but there are like all flavors of fruits and combinations and watermelon and whatever. You put it on top here and you sip through the tap. Your nose is going to pick up the scent of what this pod is scented with. Your brain is going to tell you that you're drinking water flavor water. There is no sugar. There is no preservatives. There's no there's water. You're only drinking water. And there is no water being transported in a single-use bottle, so you can use local water, which is great. And in most countries in the world, it's perfectly drinkable. It's just boring. So after 2-3 weeks, this pod will lose a scent. You replace it with another pod, so razor on razor blade model. This is, to the best of my logic, the fastest-growing company in food and bev in Europe, if not in the world.
Yeah, and good slice of creative technology there as well.
Yeah. So, and then another company that's been incredibly well performing is a British company. If you have dogs, you would be familiar with it. It's called Butternut Box. They are the pioneer and champion in Europe of fresh, like home-cooked pet food. With increase of pet adoption that we have seen during the pandemic years, you know, the penetration of, you know, pets, households, and it's increased dramatically. The UK is probably close now to 9 million dogs in homes. And there is a part of the market that has started to project their own personal family choices. If you are vegan, you would like to have no meat in the house. If you are organic, you would love to have everybody eat organic. If you are eating fresh and home-cooked rather than pasteurized and sterilized food, you would want your pets to follow the same thing. So this is another company that has grown incredibly fast this year with a subscription-only model, so D2C. All these companies are either approaching or are at or above the 100 million mark. So it's not small growth. This is real large growth with support of a lot of technology in all of them. And I think these companies would have been blended into the mix of everything else until last year. And now these are the company that I think will stand out because of the fundamentals and the problems they're actually solving.
And the distribution model as well, which is really interesting that it's outside the big supermarkets as well. Okay, so that was what's done well in 2022. Now, let's look at 2023. Andrew, first of all, I mean, what are the events that are likely to determine the investments in the food sector in the coming year? And I'm thinking, you know, the unfolding of Brexit and the evolution of the general gentle collapse of British influence, obviously, but the as Brexit unfolds, COP targets maybe, war in Ukraine. What are you looking at as being the fundamental, the legs on which investments should stand?
Yeah, that's an incredibly simple question, but there's so many different nuances to it. It's going to be really interesting. And I'm not the prognosticator of prognosticators, as the groundhog fans will no doubt remember. But a couple of things, and Ivan touched on a few of them already. One is that the investment community over the last, let's say, 10 years, there seems to be layers to that. One is there are investors out there who truly understand the global picture, who really understand the technologies and the challenges coming through, and who are making a kind of insightful investment based on a lot of knowledge and a lot of depth. Then you've had investors who are chasing the bubble, who are sort of thinking there's a quick buck to be made by just investing in anything that happens to be, I don't know, plant-based or whatever it might be, whatever is the...
Something that sounds whizzy.
Whatever is the kind of big way to make money right now, people that you'll have investors with far less knowledge, certainly without a global perspective, jumping in and thinking they're going to make their 3x or their 5x on their money. What's happened in the last 12 to 18 months because of the global challenges we've had is that those sort of fly-by-night investors have sort of disappeared. They're putting their heads in the sand and they're going to wait until the bubble comes back again. And then you've got the other investors, the kind of original group, who truly understand food innovation, the global opportunities, and who are making who are continuing to make smart, insightful investments. So you're going to have a group of investors who are going to continue forward, making, you know, what I believe to be long-term great investments for them and their limited partners. Bringing it a level down, you've got startup companies, young companies, growing companies at different stages who are not going to be finding the capital that they thought was out there. They're not going to be getting the valuations that they've been thinking for the last five years or so are the right valuations. And those valuations are now going to be tied far more firmly to business fundamentals. So their ability to deliver a great product to consumers or to businesses, if they're a business to business, and their ability to have the fundamentals of, you know, revenue and profitability. What that's going to mean is those companies who were always thinking that their business was going to be funded through fundraising and who ignored the fundamentals of business, those companies will either A, cease to exist, or B, they'll be acquired by their peers, or they'll be acquired by larger food companies if they have some truly innovative IP and technology. So the 2023 is going to be a year of great companies continuing to get investment, which I you know, applaud, and I hope I'm one of the smart investors. We're going to have those companies who are also RANs who are going to cease to exist. And then we're going to have companies who may have great IP but have ignored the fundamentals of business who are going to be probably acquired by others in their industry or by the larger food companies who see the IP and believe they can take it forward. The last thing that's really exciting for me about 2023 is one of moving the deck chairs. Actually, let me do two things. One is moving the deck chairs and the other is scale. So we've had a lot of companies bringing great IP forward in the last 5 years. 2023 for me is a lot about scale. It's going to be taking a lot of those companies and helping them to scale their products and their technologies and start having the impact that we're looking for. And when I say about moving the deck chairs, what I'm really referring to there are the corporates and others who have been investing in a lot of innovative food companies. They're going to look back into their portfolios and they're going to decide which of those companies are truly strategic for them in the medium and longer term. And they're going to continue to work with those companies. And those corporates and those folks who have got cap tables in multiple companies, they'll decide that there are some companies in their portfolio that are no longer strategic, and they'll be looking to sell their stakes in those businesses. So we'll see some consolidation around some of the better companies, and we'll see the companies that are no longer strategic having their sort of position sold to others. So we'll see a kind of growth in the secondary category in the financial market.
So what I'm getting from both of you really is that it's time for a dose of realism, and you know that hopes, dreams, and racy haircuts are no longer going to get you the funding, and maybe an Excel spreadsheet wouldn't go amiss. I mean, would it be fair to say that there's going to be a contraction, or is it more just okay, guys? Let's be realistic.
Well, you know, every investor has run the numbers from some of the reports that you see out there, so. We used to say until a few months ago, oh, there's a lot of cash out there. Well, the good news is the cash is still out there, all of it, right? The allocation to new and existing businesses is radically changed. So if a typical fund would, you know, think about the next investment and then you do some reserves and then you have your own metrics, and different funds have different strategies, but Whatever the metric was is now flipped more in favor of, well, let's keep a little more dry powder for the existing mm-hmm. portfolio companies, the better performing, as Andrew said, because those are the ones that will return the fund to investors and create the returns and the success stories. And maybe instead of doing 10 new deals, we'll only do 3 new deals and we'll pick very carefully. So this game can be played for a while. Mm-hmm. Investors, our LPs, their investors, the whole food chain of investments learn to be patient, because all of a sudden nobody has a functioning eight ball anymore. The crystal ball has become a little bit hazy. So in those days, what you do is you take down a couple of gear boxes and slow it down a little bit and try to not make huge mistakes. But this can only work so far. And this is the beauty of this model, right? So the money train has some rules and fees and all the mechanics, whereby for 1 year, I think I fully agree with Andrew, everybody will be very careful. 24, the clock will start to tick up again. The pressure will start to mount up. I think if the war stops, we'll talk about that, as I'm sure later, but I think funds will have to start to redeploy, right? Mm-hmm. And at some point you finish taking care of your own portfolio companies and you'll still look at the new one. Now, if I go back to 2001 and 2, when unfortunately I had the privilege maybe of living through the first bubble, tech bubble bursting, funds got, we all froze in 2001 and 2. We didn't know what was going on. We had no tools. Nobody had prepared us for, how to handle that big trough of disillusionment falling down, 6,000 points. And that. I mean, we didn't know. Mm. And for a year, I think we had a jokes running at the time. If an entrepreneur were to walk into our office with a working prototype of the Star Trek transponder, I don't think we would have invested, right? The courage wasn't there. I think if I go now to today, people are questioning things. We have portfolio companies to take care of and all that. But I think, I fully agree with Andrew's views on 23 being a year of reassessment, fundamentals, and all this sort of stuff. But I think that what happened in 2002 and 2003 will or might happen in 24 and 25, which means those companies that are the good ones that Andrew talked about, the one that have the strong fundamentals, the one that will navigate through this crisis in a right way, will show up then again, because they will grow and maybe they'll need more money, but they will stand out. They will stand out even more. And for those companies, valuation may not be as relevant, because nobody will ever get fired to pay a little bit more for the best company of the sector, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what happened back then, certain companies got funded at even higher valuation than maybe necessary, because they were the one that you need to have in your portfolio, right? That's the gem of the sector of semiconductor, software, food, whatever it is. And if you are the best performing fund, you need to have it. And if you pay it a little bit more, so be it. I think this might be history that will repeat itself with the top 10% companies of each of the sectors.
Yeah, that sounds very insightful.
Just one quick thing. I want to make sure that I'm not coming across as saying that in 2023, we won't be making investments. In 2023, we'll be making investments. We'll be really excited about finding great companies. I think the point I'm trying to make is it's going to be a great year for startups. It's going to be a great year for food companies. It's going to be a great year for investors who A, have that global view, and B, truly understand the category, because valuations are getting pushed down a little. And what that means is, and it's just logic, but unfortunately most investors don't actually live logic, that as the valuations come down, it means we can get more company for our money. And that means that 2023 for us is the year when we should be buying, not selling. Yeah. So we're going to be, very active looking for great companies to invest in, and their prices should be, I hope, more reasonable than they've been over the last 3-4 years. And we'll be able to put some really strong companies into our portfolio. So I'm not going to need a Star Trek transponder that actually works before I'll make an investment. and I'm not going to be waiting until 2024. Yeah. I'll be able to make some great investments at probably a somewhat more reasonable price, which gives my limited partners a better, you know, a better piece of the action, as it were.
Yeah. So, Ivan, how could we view food and agritech in the context of the entire investment community? Is it still an attractive sector? You know, people still always need to eat, but of course, you know, in economic downturns, they have less money to spend on that stuff to eat. So, how does this put food and agritech in context in the investment world?
Yeah, I'll try to keep it short because this is, I mean, there's a bit of crystal balling here as well, but I'll give you my perspective. As you said, you know, people eat three times a day during pandemic, during wars, at least the one who can, and that's not going to stop, right? So the other thing that I don't think is going to stop is a quest for better products, you know, whatever better means for you, whether it's for health, for sustainability. A lot of the products that we consume today are conceived with, you know, supply chains and technologies that are very old. Consumers may or may not recognize them as their own products, including the brands that they carry them. So there is going to be an evolutionary process that I don't expect it's going to stop. You know, one hiccup for a year or two doesn't mean anything on the long-term journey to rethinking about how we feed those, you know, famous 10 billion that we're going to end up at some point and without burning the planet on the way. So I think that the challenges and the opportunities and the reason to have changes and adjustments for impact-minded consumer, for, you know, investors, you know, they're not going to change. So I'm still thinking this the fundamentals, reasons why we started Five Seasons 5-6 years ago are still the same. I think what we need to be careful is you know, not to, and I really agree again with Andrew, there are tourist investors in the sector. They came in because, you know, quick commerce was filling up the airwaves and the, you know, titles, and were bigger than the font that you can find to write those numbers. And they got really in love with it because, I mean, it was cool, it was sexy. But, you know, we passed on every single one of them because we just couldn't make the number work in our models. Mm-hmm. And if they don't work in our model, they're not going to work in reality. So I think, you know, there are certain business models that investor will still find attractive and others that won't. Some will be temporarily hampered. I make an example of, you know, I spoke about quick commerce. I think quick commerce, the simple math is when you have a basket of 25 euro dollar pound for purchase, it will not work, period, right? Period. Different countries have different levels, but, you know, at that level, you're just burning money, so forget it. There are other models like vertical farming. There was a huge excitement a few years ago. And, you know, when the kilowatt hour price was subsidized already, because models needed to have a local deal with the local municipality and getting kilowatts at discount and all this sort of stuff, it was just barely logically making sense on a model, on Excel model. Now that kilowatts have been, whatever, exponentially grown, those models, I think, are going to need a lot of oxygen in terms of capital for navigating through this period. And I think the financial sustainability of those models would be highly, highly questioned by any savvy investor. Yeah. But again, you know, there are certain trends where the excitement level transcends the short term. So lab-grown meat is one of the next generation of plant-based, is the current one, then we have some fermentation, and then we'll eventually the lab-grown bets will come to fruition. I always say to investors, like, why don't you invest in lab-grown? Why haven't you invested in a lab-grown meat company? And the reason is a VC fund, which has a 10-year clock, we don't think is the right instrument to fund that, because 10-year might not be enough, right? I may be controversial on this, but, you know, it's like a you know, if you're a corporate and you have infinite time and money, great, you should invest in all of them. If you are a family office where money and time don't have the same meaning, you should invest in 20 of them, and one or two will hit enormously big. Our tool and instrument, which is a venture capital fund, may not be the appropriate tool for funding that, because making an error of 5 or 6 years or 10 years is actually possible when you're running what I describe as the Ironman triathlon of food tech. All the companies are now in the swimming part, really hard, of R&D. Then there is the engineering part, which is your equivalent of your biking part, where you're borrowing technologies from semiconductor, from pharma, to get the yield of those big bioreactors, where if one microbe gets into the, you lose everything. And, it's super, super hard stuff to scale up. And then at the end of that, if you have price parity, you still have to run the marathon of consumer acceptance, right? So, really great thing. And as I said, for certain investors, even in 2023, I would say it's absolutely one of the areas where if you don't count the quarters or even the years, it would be a fantastic investment opportunity.
So a couple of things. We at Big Idea Ventures have made those 20 plus investments in cell-based that Ivan mentioned. We've got a number of those companies coming through now with the products and the ingredients that is an unlock on the cell-based side. So we're already there. This is not a 10-year horizon. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been firmly involved with in the Singaporean ecosystem now for the last 4 or 5 years. Singapore has deregulated cell-based. There's products coming out right now in that space. Most of them haven't scaled to the point where they're cost effective. So, but over the next, let's say, 2, 3, 4 years, they're going to be. A couple of things. On the food side, your question around, 2023, 2024, is it still a good investment? A lot of the technologies, a lot of the innovations that we're investing in, are fundamentally going to change the economics of trillion-dollar industries, i.e. meat, seafood, dairy, and others. So it's not a, what cool technologies are coming through that we should sort of be aware of because they're cool. A lot of the economics of the meat industry and the economics of dairy, the economics of the seafood industry are going to change quite fundamentally. And the large food companies who have been dominant in those categories for decades are going to have the share of market and their kind of economic models challenged. Because if you take 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 18 months to grow whatever kind of animal you're growing, you can now produce that meat, that meat that is absolutely under a microscope, identical to the animal meat, in months, perhaps weeks, and you don't need the field, you don't need the antibiotics in the food system, you don't need the vet, you don't need the transportation of grain to feed that animal for 18 months or 12 months or whatever it might be. You don't need any of that. So the fundamental economics of those meat, seafood, and dairy industries are going to dramatically change. So it isn't just, what cool technologies are coming through in the next year or two. It's what technologies are coming through to the point where they're going to fundamentally redraw the economics of trillion-dollar industries. And that for us is what's truly exciting about the kind of investment opportunity of food and food tech.
Yeah, which is back to your point about delivering the promise that you've invested in. And let's hope that happens pretty soon as well. Now, Ivan, we mentioned commodities earlier on. Now, the wheat market has always had quite a big influence on the global food economy, usually at the mercy of climate and oil prices, but currently largely at the mercy of Vladimir Putin. How are commodity prices likely to shape your decision making? I mean, again, it's crystal ball gazing is a bit of a fool's game, but at the same time, you have to make some sort of assumptions about how it's going to unfold.
Yeah, this is a tricky one. I mean, first of all, I'm not a commodity expert, but I think, when you read that two harvests have already been wasted in Ukraine, and if you just, even if the war stopped tomorrow, it would probably take another year for decontamination of the field to be able to, seed a proper crop or equipment to harvest it and everything else. With a lot of the commodities from Russia being blocked and not received, we're not talking about like two regions of Europe. I mean, we're talking about double-digit exporters of some of those hard commodities. And whether as an Italian, a pasta eater, I fear about it. Actually, the durum wheat that is used for pasta has nothing to do with the one that comes out of Ukraine, which is more the soft wheat that all the North African countries, for instance, eat on a daily staple with their couscous or whatever it is that's eaten there. And when we're touching about that demographic, right, where 2 cents, 3 cents on the cost of your bread loaf or anything really affect the purchasing power. I think, this war scares me if it were to continue, because it will really create this imbalance in a lot of the macroeconomic area of the world that would be affected more directly. I mean, as an investor, most of the companies that we back tend to focus on premium products, because when you're doing lower volumes, you need to find a high way of pricing it so that, you can compensate for the inefficiency of production. So a typical strategy is you start with a premium product and then hopefully, you get mass market and you pass some of those savings on to consumers. The reality is that the commodity prices and energy prices that have increased over the last year have forced every company, every single company from Nestle down to the smallest startup to try to reverse some of those inflationary trends on your supply chain onto products, fueling again the inflationary spiral that we're looking at. So, what we can hope for is for the war to stop, because both oil, gas, and then commodities like sunflower oil or wheat will eventually realign with the 30-40% swings that we see at the moment in commodity prices. I'm more concerned about that to be reset to normality for economic stability and political stability than for our startups. As I said, if we have to, we'll reformulate, a pet food recipe to use a different source of oils and fat. And if it changes a couple of cents on the, on the recipe, so be it. Premium prices can tolerate a lot easier those swings. But as a human person, I'm more worried about the repercussion of missing the third and the fourth harvest for what it causes to some other parts of the world.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And now, Andrew, earlier on you mentioned sustainability. Now, I think this is an interesting idea, because over the last year specifically, the big companies have talked about sustainability as a pillar of their model, more than just something that needs to be tacked on. And I wonder, how has this changed it as a sector? Seeing as it's now part of everyone's business, does that mean that as a sector, it's watered down because people are thinking about it as a natural part of every part of their business? Or is it actually more exciting because there's more focus and more need for products and innovation in the area?
I think it's the latter. I think when let's say if you identify sustainability as something that was sort of the flavor of the year or the flavor of the month a few years ago, at that point it was something that people were discussing. It was something that was starting to get integrated into different projects, different companies, different businesses, different industries. As it's become standard, it's now time, and it's been time for, let's say, the last year or so for companies, corporates, and others to actually start living it in all aspects of their business. So I would say it's becoming part of every decision, at least in terms of the corporates we have relationships with. Mm. We've had 8 to 10 corporates who invested in our first fund, who have been a strong kind of support system and ecosystem for the companies that we've invested in. And I'm very close to their businesses in terms of the innovation, but also how are they running their core businesses. And a lot of those corporates are bringing that sustainability into every aspect of what they do. That means in terms of the supply chain, that means in terms of the packaging throughout the supply chain, that means the end packaging for the consumer. Because there's, if you just take, for example, packaging as a kind of an aspect, yes, there's the sustainable packaging that you see on the ideally, hopefully, fingers crossed, you see on the shelf in the grocery store. But then there's a lot of packaging that's needed to protect that product throughout the supply chain and during the entire process. And, you know, you've got large food companies and medium and smaller sized food companies who are having to take into consideration that packaging aspect throughout the supply chain, not just the one that's visible to the consumer at the very end of the process. And a lot of the corporates we're involved with, that we're spending a lot of time with, reimagining or redeveloping their entire business to take into consideration that sustainability. But it's not just, and this is what's really interesting to me, it's not just because of a flag waving or PR exercise. It's actually helping the cost equation. So the kind of the commodity challenges, the inflationary challenges, the challenges we've just, you know, Ivan has just identified for us, a lot of those require us to be a lot smarter about the money we're spending throughout the supply chain, throughout every aspect of our business. What that means is that sustainability helps us to deliver great products to end consumers and take a lot of the cost out of the various steps of the chain. So it's good. It's good for the planet. It's also good for the cost structure of business itself. So any smart company out there is leveraging technology throughout the supply chain and through every aspect of their business to not only do the right thing for the planet, but also to do the right thing for their kind of economics and for their shareholders.
Yeah, absolutely. Now listen, you two have been far too fascinating and time has been dripping through your fingers like gold through a tourist investor's fingers. So I'm going to bundle up all of my last questions into one, if that's okay. Ivan, starting with you, crystal ball, please. Not a crystal ball, actually. I'll take that back. It's not. What do you find most exciting for the year ahead? And this is not a single company, but an area or an idea or a, God, I hate the word trend, but maybe it's applicable. What is exciting you for 2023 that you may look at investing your money into?
Now, I know the answer that you're hoping to get, which is I'm going to scratch my beard and think really thoroughly and come up with something like the SS mushroom or some, you know, fermented ingredients and all these cool things. Now, remember who we are, right? So we are investors. We're not the people, I put myself first. I'm not one of the smart guys that can invent a new product or come up with a new formulation or solve the problems of the world. We're merely the people that put a little bit of money in the bank account, which is the equivalent of, you know, filling up the gas tank of the car, but somebody else is driving it. So, I mean, there are, maybe Andrew has more visibility on the grassroots of the really exciting things. So I'll leave him to. I don't want to spoil his answer. He's going to give you the answer that you want. I'm going to give you the investor answer, which to some extent is a little bit alluded before. We wake up in the morning, and our job, as unglamorous as it sounds, is to try to make return for our investors. Right? That's what we do. We have different strategies on how to do that, but in a simple equation math, you know, if you enter at a low valuation, you sell at a higher valuation, and you held that transition, you've pretty much done your work, knowing that it's going to be the company that execute that part. But what we can do is to find companies that have those right economic points. I think Andrew also alluded at this at the beginning of the chat. Valuation will be reassessed to realism, right? The food industry is not software. When you see investors come in at 25 times revenues, they're doing a disservice to everybody, right? Because that's not realistic. When you look at historically the food industry, for really exciting good companies in good markets, normal market, if you're using revenue as a proxy for the valuation, because we all speak the same language there, you know, 4, 5, 6 times. Okay, that's a really great exit, right? I think what excites me for the coming period is to find those Star Trek transponder that are almost working, right? Those are companies that have really good technology, really great products, great brands. They're onto the market. They will require assistance in various ways. The one we deal with is with capital. I think there will be opportunities that great companies that we may had to pass in the past because the valuation was extraordinary, not linked to performance. Now performance has grown up, valuation might readjust, and that equation will create an opportunity for us to invest in those great companies with a fair economic model, which means we can support them, we can put more capital, and they can eventually be creating those returns that then creates the next generation of entrepreneurs because you'd be part of it. So I think from a five-season venture, even for Nathie, I wake up in the morning and what I know is that in the next 24 months, there will be some of those great companies. And in Europe, we're talking about maybe you don't need the fingers of two hands, right, to count their real great success stories. And as a food tech specialist fund, we would like to have three or four of those 10 in our portfolio. And I think in the next 2 years, there will be opportunities for us to get in with the right economic to align the interest of entrepreneurs and investors for success.
Very good. Okay, so Andrew, Ivan's got his feet on the floor. He's being very sober and rational about this. Please don't be sober and rational. Tell us about something that's going to blow our minds.
So there's two things in particular that that sort of spring to mind for me. And you know, I really want to, you know, I want to jump on Ivan's, you know, we wake up every morning to provide returns for our investors. And we too, that's obviously something we spend a lot of time focused on. Now, taking about the year ahead, and what am I particularly excited about? We've spent the last 4 or 5 years working on building and being a strong part of the ecosystem in Singapore. And there's been some really amazing, you know, we've been part of that growth. We've been part of bringing lots of different pieces of the puzzle together, the startups, the corporates, the government, academics, et cetera. It takes a, you know, it takes a village to bring these great companies to fruition. We see some true innovation coming through and the ability to build those ecosystems in new places. So for example, we're engaging with Australia. We're engaging with the Netherlands and the Nordics. There are different places who are going to become the sort of ecosystems and the focus of innovation in the food space over the next 5-10 years. And it's going to be really exciting to be a part of helping to build those ecosystems around the food technologies that they're going to be focusing in on. So there's that. There's the kind of ecosystem development piece in collaboration with governments and others. That's truly exciting for us. The other thing is, we've been even at five seasons, Big Idea Ventures and others have been priming this pump of innovation for the last 5-10 years with amazing food technology companies. For me, the next year, 2 years, 3 years is one of coming to, you know, taking that great funnel and starting to scale up those companies so that we can truly gain the benefit of the companies we've invested in and the technologies that they're bringing through for the world. And so the next year or two is very much a story of scale up and bringing those technologies and those products to a point where they can have the positive impact that we've been looking for, both as investors and as you know, people on this planet with everybody else. So it's not just about a mushroom or a cell-based or this or that. It's about taking the best of those companies and making them scaled and scalable so that they're having the impact and the potential that we've been looking for now for, you know, decades.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for all of your insight. I hope we've paid you vast sums of money for all of the gems that you've delivered us. And may functioning Star Trek transponders rain down on you in the coming year. Andrew Ive and Ivan Fanetti, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.